The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 511 of the Colombia Calling podcast. Before we go over to Emily Hart with the Colombia briefing and then on to speak to Lindsay Rankin of Prana Pacifico and a new cooking book based on her time on Colombia's Chocó Pacific Coast, and amazingly good news stories for you here. I want to give a shout out to those of you who are in the group, the NAELA, I believe it's called NAELA Group, who came down to Colombia for this last week and a half, and I had the good fortune of accompanying them in Bogota and Medellin. Some went on to Cartagena, but I stuck with them for Bogota and Medellin, and it was a great deal of fun to meet you and a great, a very relaxed group of people interested in Colombia, and I was able to discuss politics, society, and culture with myself and Veronica, and I hope that maybe in the future you guys will consider revisiting Colombia, maybe with your families. But thank you again for your time and, of course, your belief in us. It was a great deal of fun. I'm going to go over now to Emily Hart with the news, the Colombia briefing, and then we'll go on to Lindsay Rankin and talk about her adventures on Colombia's Pacific coast. Of course, if you want to support the Colombia Calling podcast, please go to patreon.com/Colombia Calling, and you can, donate a little bit every week. We're off to Mompox now for Semana Santa, and maybe we'll take a break for a week or so and be back again with you with a new fresh look at things and more people to interview. So have all of you out there have a great Easter. Enjoy this episode and see you in a couple of weeks' time.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for this week. Talk of a National Constituent Assembly continues as President Gustavo Petro develops his plan to mobilize support to reform the Constitution. Congress would need to approve the Assembly, followed by a referendum in which 13 million voters would need to assent, one-third of the electoral roll. If successful, it would be the first such assembly to be convened since 1990, when the 1886 constitution was replaced. Constitutional reforms are, according to the president, necessary in order to enable the full implementation of the 2016 peace agreement with the FARC, implement meaningful judicial and land reform, address climate change, and ensure basic living conditions for Colombian citizens. However, congressmen and women from opposition, independent, and even pro-government parties have expressed concerns about this plan. Meanwhile, Petro's reform agenda continues to stall in Congress. The Clan del Golfo, also known as the Autodefensas Gaitanistas de Colombia, have said they are open to a political negotiation with the Colombian state. Petro, however, does not recognize them as a political group as such, and has instead requested that the new prosecutor create a pathway for the group's submission to justice. This comes after Petro threatened aerial bombardment last month if the group fails to dismantle. The AGC has around 5,000 members and is responsible for approximately half of drugs exported from Colombia in recent years, according to authorities. The group is also heavily involved in illegal mining, extortion, and people smuggling. The president has ordered the capture of alias Iván Mordisco, leader of the Estado Mayor Central, the largest FARC dissident group, in order to jail him. This has further shaken ongoing peace talks with the group after a partial suspension of the ceasefire last week following the EMC attack on an indigenous community. In addition, this week has seen controversy over claims that the group contributed financial support to Petro's presidential campaign. It's an allegation both Petro and the group's peace negotiator deny, though hard-right Senator Maria Fernanda Cabal has called for investigation. The former governor of the Department of Cesar has been sentenced to 21 years and 8 months in prison and a disqualification from holding further public office. Luis Alberto Monsalvo Geneco embezzled from a school food program, inflating contract prices to make a profit. He also has a previous conviction for voter corruption. The Geneco clan are among the most powerful in the region, run by Luis Alberto's mother, matriarch Cielo Geneco, who has an arrest warrant out against her for a paramilitary-related murder. Cielo Geneco is just one of several members of the clan linked with murder, corruption, and paramilitaries. Her nephew, José Alfredo, meanwhile, is a senator for political party La U. Also this week, Aida Victoria Merlano, influencer and daughter of former senator Aida Merlano Rebolledo, has been sentenced to 13 years in prison for aiding her mother to flee to Venezuela in 2019 while she was serving a prison sentence for vote buying on behalf of the Char clan. The Chars are the most powerful political and business dynasty on Colombia's Caribbean coast. Arturo Char, a former senator, is under investigation for the same crime of voter corruption. Alex Char, brother of Arturo and former boyfriend of Aida Merlano, is mayor of Barranquilla, currently serving his third term. Last Friday in Austria, the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs concluded with a change in the international approach to the fight against drugs. A new resolution moves away from the punitive paradigm of punishing consumers, moving towards the idea of harm reduction, a public health approach designed to mitigate mental and physical health issues. The president celebrated the resolution as a triumph led by Colombia, after Ambassador Laura Gil achieved the support of 60 countries for the inclusion of two new concepts in the resolution, harm reduction and a focus on human rights. From always being on its knees, Colombia has become a leader in the world, said Petro. Colombians increasingly distrust their institutions, according to polling group Edelman, whose new study shows that only 31% of Colombians trust the government, 9% less than last year. Meanwhile, only 39% trust the media, but 64% trust companies. And the UN's annual happiness report has ranked Colombia 78th of 140 countries, down 6 places from last year and down 47 places from a decade ago. Colombia's score is particularly affected by a high perception of corruption. Finland, Denmark, and Iceland are the top 3 countries this year. The United Kingdom is at 20, the United States at 23. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening. If you value these updates or want them direct to your email or your WhatsApp, you can subscribe to the Colombia Briefing, delivered every Monday as audio and text. Just sign up to my Substack at substack.com/@EHART, or you can sign up to the Colombia Calling Patreon. La canoa de Bareque para llegar al
And we're back. This is Columbia Calling, episode 511. My very special guest this week is on the line from Medellin. I'm slightly disappointed she's not on the line from the Choco, but we're talking to Lindsay Rankin, who is, an Anglo-Australian, I like to say. She's a, now a long-term resident of the Pacific Coast. That's Colombia's Pacific Coast. But she's in Medellin, and we're just going to talk about life in general, challenges and so on. And just a little bit of a background note there. The humidity on the Pacific Coast is such that we had to change from her computer to her phone to record this. So listen to the sound a bit, because she's got damp in her phone and in her computer, and mushrooms are growing in it. So welcome on the Columbia Calling podcast, Lindsay.
What an introduction. It's certainly the humidity is formidable on the coast. And I was just back there, and I, you know, out of habit, just going through all my boxes of things, and everything is full of mold. It's incredible. Tenace. But anyway, there's so many other wonderful things that we can turn a blind eye you know, it's the price of paradise, as my friend says.
Okay. But one quick follow-up question. Can you keep a book there, or does it just mold up?
Well, I'll have to let you know on that. My passport didn't fare too well after about a year there during the pandemic. And I remember handing it over to people with quite a lot of pena, actually, you know, in the migration office, going, "I'm really sorry, I live in Choco." And they were like, yes.
So I can understand this. And that's what I mean. My thing is, I haven't been to the Pacific Coast in many, many years, and I want to go back actually when my younger son is a bit older to be able to appreciate it. I absolutely love it. I've been up and down. One of the first places I ever visited in Colombia was in 1999, I believe. I think it was. Wow. I worked for WWF, and I traveled from Bahia Malaga all the way down through the mangroves to Buenaventura.
Incredible. What a trip.
It was quite the eye-opener, obviously 99, different Colombia altogether. But you are a long-time resident out there. How did that happen?
Great question. Well, I had already been living in Colombia for quite some time, for a couple of years, and living and working in Pereira in the coffee region. And a good friend of mine had some land out there. Basically, I'd been doing bits and bobs in tourism. I was managing some boutique properties in the coffee region. And he proposed that we go on this adventure together and look at his family's land and maybe look into the prospects of doing a project out there together, like a boutique property or an eco lodge. So that was the premise. And he had me sold on avioneta and lancha. I was like, great, sounds like my kind of trip. So off we went, and I just fell in love with the whole process, like the journey, looking out this tiny little 9-seater plane window at this mass of jungle and meandering rivers. And I just thought, good grief, where are we going? You know, no infrastructure. And when we got there, it was, again, you know, it was in about 2015 I went. So it was a very different Nuki as well then. There's been lots of improvement. They actually have a paved airport now, an airstrip. Before it was a muddy runway. So there's been lots of changes in the time. But we spent about 2 weeks there, and I just fell in love with it. I'd never been to a place so pure, so free of contamination and kind of human interference, to find these cultures so intact in terms of their way of life and ancestral knowledge. And all of that just really stayed with me. So I was actually working at that point as a teacher in a bilingual school. And I remember sitting there in my desk, just daydreaming about the Pacific. And so much so that when they asked me if I wanted to renew my contract, I told them, no, I'm going to go to the Pacific. I had no plan, but I just felt it in my soul, in my bones, that I needed to be there. And I had a certain purpose to fulfill there. So I kind of launched myself into the fry pan, so to speak, because obviously associated with my job was my visa, my cushy apartment. Like, I had a nice little package. So I didn't really think it through that much. So I ended up going to Canada and got a few jobs while I was there, staying with a friend and saving some money. And it was then that I saw all of this information about retreats, yoga retreats in Mexico, Costa Rica. And I thought, you know, that place would be perfect for retreats. And so that's when the little seed was planted, and I started developing a business plan around that. I say business plan, I mean scribbles in my diary about what it would be like and the name and logo and things like that. I didn't really even do a budget, to be honest. And so went back there with that plan. So I returned in end of 2017 with the idea that I was either going to buy a piece of land, build something, rent something. And that's when I discovered Morro Terco, which was for 3 years, the home of Prana Pacifico.
So tell us exactly where you are, because you're not, I mean, if we look at the map, you look out west to the Colombian Pacific Department of Choco, huge department, and the capital is kind of in the center called Quibdó. And then if you're flying west from there, almost directly west from there, it's Nuquí, but you're not in Nuquí.
No, I'm a little south from Nuquí. It's about a 40-minute boat ride along the coast. Mm. So it's wonderful. It's funny, bless my mom. She always says, oh, how's the island? You know, because it has a feeling of an island because you've got forest on one side with no road access. And then you have Pacific Ocean and this very long, wild strip of coastline, which, as you said, mm-hmm. you know, runs all the way down to Buenaventura. So it's absolutely stunning. There's seven corregimientos from Nuquí, well, starting just before Nuquí, which is Jurubira. And then it goes Nuquí, Pangui, Coqui, Jovi, Termales. And so Termales is the little fishing village where I chose to make my home. There's about 270 people, predominantly of Afro-Colombian descent. There's no energy or light. There's just a community planta, the generator that's turned on from 3 till 10 every day. And if anybody wants to continue a party or watch the rest of their movie or whatever, they have to use their own source of power, which is either a generator or if they have solar. So it's a very different lifestyle for sure.
Termales obviously means thermal, so it's I think I've been there many years ago, and there is a thermal area to go and bathe, right? And is this where obviously you can't harvest it, but you can find wild vanilla pods around Termales?
Exactly. I see you've done your research. Hey, well done. Yes, well done. Yeah, it was
just
really
an investigation in that one.
Yes. No, there was a biologist called Catalina who I think she went to the coast maybe 15 years ago or something like that. It's a long-term project. And she discovered all of these native species of vanilla, basically. So now it's been developed into a community project where they're actually mm-hmm. cultivating this vanilla for export, national and international. And obviously, it's, I think, the second most valuable spice in the world. So it obviously has a great deal of potential. And the fact mm-hmm. that it does grow, it actually grows from an orchid. I wasn't aware of that. I was part of the mm-hmm. orchid family. So it's a really cool project. And there's so many now emerging from the Pacific. And I think it's a real shift in perspective, especially on a national level, because this part of Colombia has been ignored for so long. Mm-hmm. It's been feared for so long. And there's still so many Colombians don't even know of it. Like when I say, oh, I live in Nuquí, they're like, where? They act as if it's a different country, you know? And then there's, of course, a lot of ignorance and misinterpretation or whatever, or maybe a little bit Antigua kind of feelings about the place in terms of safety and what can be found there. There's often people make the comments like, oh, but it's black sand. Like, oh, you know, it's not the Caribbean with the crystal clear waters and the white sandy beaches. But for me, the palette of colors of the Pacific is like nowhere else. Like the rich greens and the like beautiful kind of teal of the water and these, you know, and the contrast with the dark sand. For me, it's so unique and so special. So it's really interesting that now, like I said, there's been a bit more value placed in like plant medicine, for example, and the viche, the ancestral production of viche, which is now being recognized and sought after. Coconuts, like the traditional way of harvesting and cultivating rice, like there's actually kind of been, because of the value placed on these things now with a bit of a shift maybe post-pandemic and also just people wanting more of a healthy kind of off-grid lifestyle perhaps, there's a real shift towards that again It's really nice to see the people returning to cultivating the land and feeling validated, I guess, for their way of life, you know?
I think when we think of the palette of colors or the Pacific, I always describe the Pacific when I used to do guidebooks and stuff as being just entirely natural, where the jungle sort of tumbles into the ocean. And I don't have any issue with it being a dark sand. It all complements one another. I want the Pacific coast to be different to the Caribbean coast. And you don't tell me that Cartagena itself doesn't have any white sandy beaches. You have to go elsewhere for those. So let's just stop. The Pacific coast is something very, very different. And I just think that's, you know, this, I have obviously, I've done my investigation for another company about the vanilla, and you obviously had a look into what's going on with the Viche liquor. Yeah. I haven't tried it myself. I'm kind of steer clear of those sorts of things.
I'm coming to Bogota next week. We'll have to meet up, and I'll introduce you to this magical drink.
Yeah, I'm sure it has magical effects and a magical morning after. But that said, I just picked up there for you spent the pandemic in the Chocó.
I did. I spent about half of it in Medellín, and the other half of it, I was able to get a humanitarian flight back, I went. Mm. And but it was actually a really interesting time because, you know, obviously a lot of my friends work in tourism. They have cabins, things like that. It was completely dead. So people really carried on life as normal in terms of they still went fishing. They still did this. And a lot of my other friends, they just started doing other projects. Like one friend started making wine out of Porto Hall because there was no beer coming. There was no cargo boat with supplies and no one had the money to afford it. So all of these like little projects came up. Well, how can we, you know, drink? Well, we'll make our own wine. So I have to say, I was not a big fan of the Porto Hall wine at all. But my French friend survived on it over the pandemic. So
I don't know, Borojo wine. I mean, obviously, like everything, if you don't really like it, it's an aphrodisiac.
that's
kind of the rule behind it. But let's hear a little bit about, I mean, your arrival in the Pacific. It was meant to be, but it's not. You know, I always think that, you know, we setting up businesses in Mompox, you know, that's out there, it's rural, but of course we have roads coming in and so on, and we can get things more or less easily. The Pacific coast is even further. I mean, that's taking on a challenge. Perhaps you could share some of, I don't know, how were you accepted to begin with when you said, oh, I'm going to settle here?
Yeah, the community is so beautiful. Like I said, it's a very small, tight-knit community. Most people are related by, you know, in some way or another. So it is quite a tight unit to integrate to. People are always very outwardly friendly, but I did find it difficult to get more into that circle of trust and be seen as a resident rather than just a passing tourist. And initially with Prana Pacifico, because I was based in Moroterco, a 2 kilometer walk from the village, it really was that I would come to buy things and leave, or I would, you know, come with my group of tourists and parade them through the town and then leave. And so it was very hard at that stage to really gain the full acceptance. I think people were very curious about me because especially Moroterco, it had a lot of mysticism around it. It was a private property that was never really open or available to a lot of the local people. And then for a single woman to come and take it on and live there and make it into like a moving, profitable business, I feel that I gained a lot of respect for that, you know, like, so that was a big way of kind of integrating into the community. And I think just with time and really for me, especially with the women, because I think it's always a bit harder with women. Like, obviously, there was a natural curiosity for the men because it's fresh meat in a small town, you know, how it goes. But to actually gain the trust of the women and for them to accept me as a friend and not a threat, that was tricky. You know, I went there very laser focused on my business. I definitely wasn't interested in anything else. But the kitchen for me was where I really gained the trust and the respect of the women and where we shared ideas and grew together as cooks and it was a wonderful moment, I think. And initially, again, they were very skeptical because, you know, the people, the women of the Pacific are revered for their gastronomia. And so they're kind of like, who's this white chick and who does she think she is, you know? So, and obviously I had some more exotic ideas from my travels and things I've seen, you know, in different places around the world. So trying to implement this merriment of, okay, well, here are these local ingredient staples, if you will, you know, the banana, the coconut, fish, it's pretty much what you have to work with. How, what can we do with that to make it more interesting? And how can we enhance the flavor? And what can we combine it with? And how can we present it? So initially, I think they thought I was absolutely bonkers. But then poco a poco, like trying my food, and I started to get these slow little nods of appreciation, like never like, hey, well done, you're doing great. But just a little sly, like, you know, discreet kudos. And then, like I said, building relationships and working shoulder to shoulder in the kitchen, solving problems which always arise, like the fisherman didn't catch fish. What are we going to make for lunch? Like, you know, so those types of situations really make you form a tribe, I think, and earn respect. And I always say, you know, when you're in the trenches with someone, you depend on them, you trust in them. Yeah. And that's what it was like there. So it was a long process. But, you know, I'd just been out of the country for about 6 months and I came back and I felt like a queen. You know, everybody was like, wow, welcome back. And the kids ran and greeted me. And, you know, so I feel very much like I'm an appreciated part of the community now. After 5 years of battling, yes, I've finally been accepted, which has been wonderful.
So, I mean, you wrote up your business plan, and then Prana Pacifico was born. This is what you're talking about with the cooking and learning traditional cooking and so on. What does this Prana Pacifico mean?
Yeah, so I mean, I love the name actually, and it kind of came about. I mean, Prana is very commercial, let's say. Everything's prana, really. But what it means is vital energy, life force energy. And really, that's what I felt there. Like, even to the ongos that grow in your computer and in your sealed boxes, I mean, it is life. Like, everything, you know, the jungle is alive. There's abundance of water and growth. And it's just incredible. So that, for me, was where the name came from. And obviously, it has its ties to yoga. And that was what the business was all about, was, okay, let's create experiences for people. And it wasn't your typical woo-woo kind of, you know, super serious, go on a mega diet for the weekend. No, it was really like, let's enjoy and connect and feel. And I think that place was so perfect for it, you know, but especially in Morro Terco, because it's exclusive. You're on this Morro, which is kind of like an island, 250 stairs to get up the top. So you really feel like you're in this kind of, you know, special cocoon. You're in this private place. So to host these retreats where people were, you know, eating conscious food and sitting together to eat, you know, active during the day, whether it was yoga classes or hikes in the jungle and swimming in the ocean. And really, it was like, how can we bring people together and just raise the consciousness, like, you know, about where the food is coming from and how is it prepared? And let's take a minute to enjoy eating it and be present and not have any phones. And obviously, at that point, we had no signal and no Wi-Fi or anything like that. So that was a huge help. But what I really observed is, again, the same as I said, is like going through the battles together. That's really outside people's comfort zone. To go on a small plane, a tiny boat, climb 250 stairs, stay in a treehouse on top of a hill, like, you know, it's really uncomfortable for a lot of people. But to go through that with support and guidance and good company, and eat well, you know, it was just people left really happy and, you know, really transformed and with a different perspective of what the Pacific was all about, which was kind of the idea.
And what was your demographic, Colombians to international visitors?
Yeah, it was actually a really interesting mix. I would say it was 50-50, to be honest. Like, there was a lot of expats living in Colombia. Groups came completely from the exterior. Like, we had it registered on bookyogaretreats.com so people could join retreats from overseas. And also, it depended who I made the alliance with, because I wasn't responsible for the classes. My kind of business model was that I was the hostess, the tour guide, actually the massage therapist, and the chef, and created like the package of experience with local providers, which was really wonderful as well, because we got to all grow together. I mean, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, so it was really nice, and neither did they. So it was kind of growing collectively as well, which was really nice. And also funneling people into these local services. You know, they didn't have a phone, they don't have a web page, but, you know, I had this power that I could, you know, privilege, if you will, to communicate to the external world and bring people in. So I think that helped with the kind of the respect in the village as well, is that I wasn't just there taking, I was offering and supporting and giving opportunities to other people. And a lot of the time with the retreats, we had a spin-off that we would either offer classes to the local community, or as an offset, we would get like instruments. We did a music retreat, Marimbea, with a company in Bogota who focus in Pacific music and things like that. And we did a retreat with them. So they came, I think, three times in the end. And with the profits, we invested in getting local instruments made in the traditional way by the elders that used to do it, who are like 70 now. And unfortunately, the knowledge will die with them. But, you know, making these beautiful tambores with the hide of jungle boar that was hunted and brought to me bloody for me to stretch out on the floor where the people do the yoga. I mean, you know, quite the tale. But such a wonderful, like, you know, reciprocal relationship. And that was the big point of it as well. It's like, how can we create opportunity for other people? How can we support other local businesses to thrive and grow? So yeah, it was definitely a challenging time. It's probably the hardest job I've ever had in my life, and definitely the lowest paying. but it was so formative for me as a person. Yeah. And I really did learn so much. And mostly about my own capability.
Hardest job, lowest paying, most rewarding. Yeah. They often go together.
Yes. Especially when everything got pulled off. Like, despite all of the odds and all of the challenges. And I always use the analogy of like a duck on water. You know, the little duck looks so calm on the surface, and underneath the little feet are going like crazy, you know? And that's pretty much was my whole time with Prana Pacifico. It was like this image, like everything's under control. And in the kitchen, we're like, oh my God, what are we going to cook for these people in 2 hours? Because there's no fish, or, you know, the delivery of food didn't arrive from the boat. So now what are we going to do? So it was this constant, you know, think on your toes, invent, create, solution, distract, you know. But it was wonderful. And then of course, when everybody leaves at the end of the weekend and they're happy and you collapse in an exhausted heap, yes, I felt extremely rewarded. During, not always, but kind of like running, you know, you appreciate it afterwards.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a lot of the issues I have, not so much with food, but in Mompox, it's always logistics. It's always the logistics of transport in the Caribbean. I'm sure it affects you far more because it's boats and so on. The guy just decides not to wake up and I'm not working today. I mean, that's always, you know, like, we've been working together for 5 years. Come on. But it's one of those. I want to know, and I think my listeners want to know more about the cooking experience, about you learning and cooking alongside the local community. Tell us a little bit. I mean, because that's not easy to penetrate, you know, to be with the women and to cook, because that's a very, I'd say it's a sacred place, you know, the kitchen.
Yes.
So give us a little bit of a background about that.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I never really intended to cook. My plan was to do all the other things I mentioned. And I had a friend who actually has a wonderful restaurant, if anyone's in the coffee region, called Latinos. And he's a good friend of mine, great chef. And he was going to come out and cook. And in the end, he got a great opportunity to go and do some, I don't know, I think he got on television or something like that, and so couldn't come. So I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to have to do it now. So he sent his assistant to kind of just support me a little bit. And we just took it from there and designed a kind of a menu based on what we could find and bring easily. And I obviously had a lot of support from the local women. And like I said in the beginning, I think because it's also, it's not a culturally and typically in the region, it's not about working necessarily side by side. It's more that I hire you and you do what I say. So all of a sudden now I'm very much more like, okay, well, what do you think? Like, how do you think we should do this? And actually it wasn't as well received as I anticipated. I thought, you know, being a woman and being a little more collaborative in my approach, like I might gain a bit of like friendship and respect from that. But in the beginning, I think I was seen as like a bad manager because I wanted people's input and I empowered them to have a voice. And so even something as basic as that was a challenge, you know, because I came at it from this completely different perspective. And first of all, they're not used to having a lady boss. And second of all, they're not used to having a nice lady boss that wants to actually work in a team. So that was the first kind of hurdle was, okay, how do I, you know, have respect as a manager, as a leader, but also work collaboratively and like we all share ideas and everybody's empowered to make choices and contribute. So that was the first issue. And then I think it was just about like fine tuning, like the women there are exceptional chefs and they have so much knowledge about the plants and their benefits and how that's kind of incorporated in the cooking. So you're not, it's actually medicinal food, you know, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just taking that and then fine tuning it with presentation, with stepping outside of like the normal ways of preparing the food and, you know, coming at it for, from a slightly different perspective. So yeah, it was, like I said, it took some time to get to that point. And like I said, I think they thought I was absolutely bonkers and completely incompetent for the first at least year. But then, like I said, people started trying the food and it came out good and people responded well to it. And then they were asking to take it home to their family. So that was when that shift really happened, was like, oh, okay, it's different, but it's still cool. You know, like that was that kind of, yeah. So it was a really beautiful experience. And, you know, also I think what the women gained from it as well was this exposure to a more intimate relationship with the guests, you know, like we would sit and eat together and there would be lots of interaction. They would come join us for some yoga classes. So I think it was that as well that really was the kind of value exchange. You know, it was like, okay, well, you've got this base of like incredible ancestral knowledge about the region and about the products. And then I came in here with a slightly different approach and ideas and it all came together really well in the end.
I think phenomenal. Some weeks ago, we had I want to call her food academic, a Colombian food academic on the show called, her name's Juliana Duque. And she does write-ups for hotels and other things. She's on a podcast, the New Worlder podcast, which is very good about food and so on. And I entitled the podcast episode, is Colombian Food Isn't Bland, It's subtle. And how would you, as someone very much involved in that, respond to that kind of that kind of description?
To be honest, this is a conversation I've had with a lot of friends. Is
you've gone
based on the wonderful produce available in the country. I've always felt a little disappointed. Listen, I've had this discussion with a lot of my friends, and I do believe that for the amazing offering of fresh produce that Colombia has, the gastronomy is a little disappointing. I feel that it could be definitely developed and explored and exploited a lot more than it is. I think the Pacific is definitely the exception because they have such interest to work with, and like you said, the coconut and the fact that the coconut becomes the base for a lot of the sauces and soups and things like that, amazing fresh seafood, the patacón, you know, it's got this very defined signature taste and flavor that people seek, you know, like so that for me is the exception. But honestly, I do find it quite, I often find that in Colombia, if you go to a slightly fancier place, it's almost kind of over the top in its effort to be fancy. It's too many things all at once. And it's actually, you lose it. It's too many stars in the show. So like a telenovela, too much drama. You know, I prefer something. And I think that's probably the key to my cooking because I'm not really a fancy chef. You know, I've never professionally studied gastronomy or cooking is something that I've just developed very intuitively because I love to eat mostly. And I would say that my cooking is very simple and very subtle, and it plays on how do I enhance the natural flavor of this dish and all these products. And so that's kind of what I've played with. And obviously, you know, different textures and colors, because I do think that presentation is so important. And I'm not an artist at all. I'm not, you know, drawing, painting is not my thing. But when I plate a dish, like I really enjoy the intricacy of making a pretty picture, you know. So, yeah, that would be my comment. I also do like quite a bit of like, I like strong flavors like ginger and cilantro and spice, very kind of Southeast Asian inspired flavors. And obviously you don't get a lot of that here. So that always, I'm always adding things, you know. I'm like, do you have ahi? Can I have some black pepper? Just to give it a little kick.
Yeah. But they've got good ahi on the Pacific Coast. They've got good ahi. Yeah. And they've got good spicy sauce. I like it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the rest of the country is a bit mild.
Yes. Yeah. No, we actually just on the way back yesterday from the coast, obviously had the obligatory empanada as you leave at 8 a.m. Fish empanada with this beautiful, like, coconut spicy sauce. Wow. Mm. Amazing. Amazing. Mm. Yeah.
That's very good. So tell me and tell us about the book. The book.
The book. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's actually so wonderful for it to finally come to fruition, because it's been a very long-term project. And if anybody's had any experience with like writing or anything like that, I'm sure they can relate. And there's definitely been lots of phases of inspiration and complete, you know, abandonment of the project. So it's definitely been a roller coaster. But the idea started, I always had a photographer making highlights videos and getting promotional content for the retreats. And often during the retreats, people would say, wow, I want the recipe. And I would just like scribble it on a post-it note, you know, that was probably going to get soggy and shoved in a bag somewhere. But the lady that was helping me with these retreats, Manuela Eres, who is the principal photographer for the book and a very talented photographer, said to me, amiga, why don't we start taking pictures of your food and we can make a recipe book? And it hadn't even dawned on me, to be honest. I was so busy being the tour guide, the massage therapist, the cook and everything else that it hadn't even really dawned on me. So it was quite an organic process. And every retreat, she would take her camera out and we'd record a bit of the production of the things and, you know, take a bit of effort to make something look pretty and get the right light and take the picture, which again is a lot more of a production than I ever imagined. You know, there's a lot more to it, and my mad respect to her, because the images that she took are just spectacular. And it is really hard food photography, actually, like to really get the dimension and the depth and for it not just to look like a blob on a plate is not easy. So she did a really, really good job. And so we did that actually first, and it was mostly then poco a poco, like in the pandemia and whenever I had spare moments, that I would sit and actually had to quantify all of my recipes, because they were all completely empirical, intuitive, like a little dash of this and a shake of that and just feeling, you know. So then I actually had to sit down and go, well, how much is a shake actually? And how much is a little pinch, and quantify all of my recipes. And once I had all of that, then it was okay, well, what story do I want to tell? And how do I link this all in to make it a bit more human and personable and share kind of the background story a little bit behind the food and the recipes? Yeah, that's how it all really began. And I have to say the process was actually extremely therapeutic for me, because I was forced to sit and review all of my old photographs and revisit all of these funny stories in the process of going out fishing for the first time or trying to open a coconut for the first time or learning about all the medicinal plants that I could use also in the kitchen to give flavor to the food. And so it was actually a wonderful therapeutic, cathartic experience. And now that I'm on the other side again, I feel alleviated. I feel like I've kind of released some of these, I don't know, feeling, stories, experiences that I've been carrying, you know, for the last 5 years, and hopefully sharing it in a medium that's inspiring and helps promote the Pacific and share the wonderful, magical place that it is and help create, again, more opportunities for the people that live there. So that's kind of the intention, let's say, behind actually getting this book out there.
So it's called Prana Pacifico, A Taste of Paradise?
It's actually just called A Taste of Paradise, and it's recipes okay. and reflections from living off-grid on the Colombian Pacific Coast, because that's the whole other element as well, yeah. I think, is that it's mostly about, I think what it was for me is the consolidation between the original pipe dream or image I had about starting this life in this magical, exotic place, and then the actual reality of it, you know, because obviously I was like, great, I'm just going to go live in Chocó and everything will be fine. And like I said, I didn't even really think twice. I deliberate more on what to eat for dinner than I did in move there. You know, I mean, really, I if I thought about it properly, I probably wouldn't have done it, which is, you know, blessing and a curse in the same time. But I think for me, like I said, I kind of had this image that I would go there and live this kind of idyllic hippie lifestyle where I would grow all my own food and harvest it and just cook only with that. And in the reality, you know, it's really tough, actually. It's a full-time job to maintain a garden, especially when you're fighting against aguaceros and the, you know, leaf eater ants and the parrots and also, you know, so many factors. And so that was a huge wake-up call. And I think also just about, yeah, like there's no rappy, you know, when there's no fish, there's no fish. You can't go to another supermarket and find it. So it's just the assimilation, I think, of what I imagined it to be and then the actual reality of it. And, you know, now, to be perfectly frank, I love the Pacific, but I don't necessarily see it as somewhere I want to live full time. The humidity is a factor and so many other things. I think also it is just so remote and the logistics, as you said, is an absolute nightmare. But it's still and always will be such a magical place for me. And I also have my house there now. So that's my other kind of project that's coming to completion, hopefully just in time for the whale season. But it's my own house, Casa Prana. So after my contract ended with Moro Terco, the people that I rented the property from, I bought my own piece of land. And then, yeah, the real adventure began. And I started to build, design and build my own house. And I was very involved with the process in terms of going to the jungle and carrying on my shoulder big planks of wood down this muddy track, you know, and bringing it to my land. And obviously from the designing and bits and bobs and things like that. So I'm so happy now to have this beautiful space that I've created so that I can share that with people too, the people that want to go to the Pacific, but maybe just want a little bit of support in getting there and want a comfortable place to be when they get there. Well, I've done all the hard work for you and it's all ready to go. So hopefully from August on, if anybody is interested in going to the Pacific, then feel free to reach out and you can go Airbnb my beautiful jungle chic home.
I think we'll be there. But have you ever read Paul Theroux's The Mosquito Coast?
No.
Oh, you'd relate to it. I mean, it's dated, of course. It's 80, from the 80s, I believe. But of course, he takes his family off grid in what is the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua. But it's all about that, the hard work of setting up. And I, you know, there's other different angles on the story, but I think you'd relate to it very much. So
carrying like
planks.
Yes.
When and where can we get the book?
Okay, so the book will be available on Amazon on the 19th of March, Tuesday, this coming Tuesday. So you can order your hard copy or a digital copy for your Kindle. At the moment, we only have it online in English, but I'm currently printing in Spanish as well. And so via my website, people can order in Spanish if they so wish.
What's your website?
That's a great question. Can we put it in the notes? I think it's just literally www.lindsayrankin.com, but let me just double check
that. I'll put it in the notes. It'll all be there. Don't worry. Lindsay.
Wonderful. I'm pretty sure it's just mynamedotcom, but just in case it isn't, or there's a sneaky little point there, then.
Have you got the fungus has not just affected your computer? It's got in there, Lindsay. You've been affected by the Pacific Coast, and that's wonderful. It's really great, and I really enjoy conversations of this type that are so upbeat and so, well, I don't want to say positive, and you appear to be in a position right now that is so, I would say, enviable. You seem very happy. And, you know, with this idea of what's going on, of course, you've said you don't want to live full time on the Pacific coast, but the Pacific has taken part of you. And 100%. You will be there.
100%. Yeah. And, you know, it's almost become part of my identity, you know, like it really has. I carry that knowledge with me and those experiences with me. And like I said, it's just living in a close-knit community like that. I think we've really lost touch with that now, especially all in apartments, closed doors, you know, everything's private and, you know, it's almost hard to go knock for a cup of sugar or something nowadays. Whereas there, especially in the hard times, there's always that, you know, how they have the Colombian expression, pueblo pequeño, infierno grande, or infierno grande. Yeah. But actually, even with all the discussions and problems and quejas, when it really counts, if someone gets sick and they need to get to Nuquía or to Medellín, everybody's there for you, even the people that you had the discussion with the other day. And so that's something that I've really carried with me as well, as a sense of community and helping each other out and, yeah, collaborating, you know, like working as a team, as a collective to get goals. I mean, even basic things like getting a medical person out to do a brigada or the vets out to do a sterilization. It's such a huge effort, but together we kind of make it, because you have to advocate yourself because no one else will, you know? So you're in this very remote, isolated community. You can't depend on the state. You can't depend on, you know, there's no hospital. There's not even really any lay out there. So you the community takes on a whole other role in your life. You know, it's not just like these people that are around. It's like they're my family. And if I can help them, I will. And they've very much been the same with me. So I definitely feel like I have a home there and a family there. And even if I'm not deciding to kind of live there full time, and maybe it's just because of my age, I still feel that I want to travel and explore and have new experiences. And actually I'm relocating to Chile in the middle of the year to open a restaurant on the Pacific coast there. So you can definitely say there's at least a theme. I'm just in love with the Pacific coast, wherever it may be. And this is a very different Pacific coast. It's cold and windy and wild in its own ways. But I'm so ready to just launch into that hot fry pan again and survive and create and you know, see what happens and learn and grow and share. So if anyone's traveling to Chile, Pichilemo, look me up. I'll be there.
I think what I like most, I'm enjoying everything here, Lindsay, but what I'm enjoying the most is the Spanglish coming through.
And, oh my gosh, I'm terrible for it.
When you talked about the person you had the discussion with, well, of course, that's the Spanglish, because the discusión is an argument in Spanish, but it's discussion in English. I love it. I talked about an inversion the other day, an investment. And so, you know, it happens to the best of us.
I think. That's how, I mean, I talked to my mom and actually she came to visit me in about 2015. So she made the trek out and there were so many funny things that she picked up, like the lip thing, you know, when you've got your hands full and you know. So she was like, what on earth is going on with your face? Like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah. But so I often speak to my mom and all this Spanglish comes out. And I think she's actually slowly learning Spanish from my, you know, my influence of just slotting in those Spanish words into our everyday conversation. I can't help it.
Lindsay, let me take this moment to say thank you so much for your time and your generosity in sharing the experience. I feel like I've almost already visited you out there. I will, but it's really been special to listen to this. And I wish you all the best, not only with your home, but also with the book. And then, of course, the restaurant in Chile. I mean, is there any end to your skills and capabilities?
We'll soon find out.
Listen, well, we'll close this off now. Check out check out the book. Of course, we'll be putting it all up on the show notes and social media, Taste of Paradise. Look up Lindsay Rankin. Of course, we'll have her website up as well. This has been episode 511 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We'll be back next week with further interviews with people talking about Columbia or Columbia as a lens for a conversation. This has been a really fun, upbeat episode, and I know you'll all have enjoyed it. So, of course, subscribe or support us on patreon.com/Columbia Calling, and we'll be back next week again. Thank you. And
the Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Columbia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Columbia Calling website, that's www.columbiacalling.co, or the BNB Columbia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.